This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Hawaii pays homage to Dr. Livingston Wong tonight, a pioneer in organ transplants in the islands. He performed the very first kidney transplant 50 years ago. St. Francis Liliha will host an evening in his honor. Dr. Wong's work had a profound impact on so many in our community and saved so many lives. We recently were invited as a recipient of a kidney, met the family who donated their son's organ to save her life. The gathering took place at Ho'omalohia Park, a place where both the donor and recipient played as children. Legacy of Life director Felicia Wells-Williams sets the stage.
Today we have a donor family. The family of Ka'avika Paiva is going to be meeting with one of the recipients of their son's kidney. She's a local lady who just celebrated her 30th birthday, and she's going to be meeting with the family for the first time. She's been a recipient of Kavika's kidney for 3 years. Kavika died about 3 years ago.
And so what precipitated this meeting then?
You know, it's really common for people who receive an organ to want to say thank you to the people who gave it. And it's really common for a family to want to have a chance to meet the person. But actually going through the steps and making it happen, usually something will stop them along the way. And so today's meeting, while it's commonly wished for, it rarely occurs. And so both the donor family, particularly Kavika's mother, Kathy, and Jennifer have been communicating by mail. They've been, you know, sending letters to each other through our office. And then they will be meeting today for the very first time after both just really giving some thought to what will it mean to finally meet each other in person.
And are we here for a particular reason?
We're here at the garden because this place had a very special meaning for Kavika. This is some place that he would spend time, and I think that from his family's perspective, it's the perfect healing space to, one, honor Kavika's gift, to remember the amazing thing that he did, that even though his life couldn't be saved, he saved others after his death, and to have an opportunity to meet the person that was touched by his gift in a place that he loved, I think will be really special for both the family and the recipient.
And he died young, at 20 years old.
20 years old,
and
yes, he did.
He didn't actually sign up to be a donor, but his family was able to say this would be something important to do.
Yes, they did. Kavika did not make that decision while he was alive. So what that means is that then when he died, a member of our team went in and met with his family during a really critical time. And so they said yes to donation. And as a result, two people in Hawaii were saved because of Kavika's gift.
And Kavika's mother, Kathy, was looking forward to this day, this meeting, for a long, long time.
Always wonder what she would look like, how she would be. She's so super grateful. And the fact that she loves Jesus makes it even that much more special for me.
And we're here at Ho'omalohia, and it's like both of your families come here, you know?
Yes.
You're from the same area.
Yeah, she actually went to Pu'uhala Elementary, King Intermediate, and Castle High School, as well as my son Kavika did the same. So it's like, what are chances of it being, you know, the way it turned out to be? And then come to find out at Grace Bible, where she goes in Pearl City, my daughter is one of her best friends. Actually had made a comment like, hey, Kuanani, I think I know who got Kavika's kidney. And we weren't really sure. Apparently, Jen had given her testimony. And it was around the same time, so Janine, also a nurse, had put two and two together and kind of thought that it might be. And we come to find out that it really is her. Yeah.
So how is it that you folks connected? Who made the first step, or I don't know how this works.
She actually did, and I always wanted to. And then I guess when the timing for her was right, she said, you know, she really felt that God said now is the time, and so we finally connected. Yeah.
And I imagine though this is going to be the first of many gatherings.
Yeah, I would like that to happen. And then my husband, who was having a hard time right now, still yet, with the passing of our son. I'm hoping one day that he would be, you know, open to meeting her, and I think it would help him with his healing process.
And you have a grandson.
Yes, that's Kamalu. Kamalu, His middle name is Kavika's middle name, which is Kalani Makana O Akua, which means heavenly gift of God. And so in more ways than one, Kavika was a gift to me, but Kavika was also a gift to Jen. And I think that's even more special.
And I'm hearing bits of the story about how he was born at the hospital the same time that this transplant was happening.
Yeah. So how I put it is they're both in the Queen Emma Tower. One was giving birth while the other was giving life. So my daughter was giving birth to Kamalu, and at the same time, Kavika was giving life to Jen and his other recipient.
And I just talked to Jen's mother, and she's just so grateful that your baby saved her baby.
Yeah. You know what? You can always find something good in something tragic. And Romans 8:28 says that, and we know that all things work for the good of those that love God and work according to His purpose. And even though it's all things, that means even the bad stuff, you know, that we consider bad, something good can come out of it. And this is something, not just good, it was great. I couldn't have planned it any better, you know. And I'm grateful to know at least one of his recipients, you know. And just like I said, knowing that she knows God and how much Kavika, you know, loved God, that the connection is just, there's a bond. It's beyond a connection. It's a bond.
Well, yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Anything else you want to say?
There is a need for donors, and it's something that's not highly talked about. And I even told my husband, I said, you know, some people might think it's just a kidney, but it's not just a kidney to the person that's receiving it. Even if they're on dialysis, eventually that kidney will fail. And if they don't get one in time, they will die. And that was a reality that had set in for myself. One of my girls that we were all going through Bible studies together, her husband died because he never received a kidney. And so the reality really is there. It's not just talk, but I've experienced it, you know. And my hope and wishes with all of this is that not just I got to connect with Jen and that good feelings and all that stuff that goes along with it, but it's also to bring awareness that, hey, people, we need people to step up. I know you're going through what you're going through, but if there's something good that can come out of it, think about what that person would have done that had passed. Would they want to do this? You know, sometimes you got to put your emotions on the side. You cannot think with your emotions because it'll mess you up every time. You know, you got to think what that person would want. And I knew without a doubt, like as soon as I knew that Kavika had passed, I kept praying for a miracle. And I told God, I said, upon the time that we pull him off the machine and he doesn't breathe, that will tell me that the answer that you're giving me is no. And when the answer was no, I did quickly run out and I wailed, honestly. But when I went out and I sat down, I told my husband, the first thing I told him was, we need to give whatever we can. We got to donate whatever organs that, you know, can be donated, you know, from Kavika. And surprisingly, he didn't fight me on it. And so that's what we did. And I don't regret it, you know. And it is a blessing in disguise for me.
That was Kavika's mom, Kathy. And Febe Gia is Jennifer's mom. She said her daughter had been in line to get another kidney, but it had not been a good match. She felt Kavika's gift was part of a bigger plan and is forever grateful to the Paiva family for extending her daughter's life.
If somebody will go, somebody will come. That's the one, when you do the crossover in our life, we have to accept it. It's not beyond our control. So whatever plan and the will of God in our prayer, they will be done. For both of them, yes.
There's so many smiles here today. Lots of kids, and I'm sure your families will become close because you're from the same area.
Yes, imagine. I can't believe it. That's why it's not really a coincidence for me if you think about it. In our carnal living, we call it coincidence. But in divinity saying it's God's plan.
Right. Yes. And then the fact that you both families would come here to Old Malahida Park.
Yes.
It's a special place.
Special place.
And anything you want to say to Kavika's mom?
Oh, yes. The moment when the kidney transplant is going, I cannot express I'm overwhelmed on that night. And the only thing I say, thank you, Jesus, because he's the only one made of things possible to my daughter. And I know on the other hand, if even this Kaviko's family, I know there are, it's hard to depart somebody loved ones. But on the other hand, I believe both of us, we know about Jesus. There we can make a connection that these are things happening in our lives. It goes back again. Thy will be done. Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The family of Kaviko and the moment Jen received the kidney transplant, always in my prayer and in my heart.
Jennifer Gia shares that she was just about to graduate from nursing school when she discovered that her kidneys were failing.
I think the overall feeling would be, I guess, humbled and just grateful, because I know it's been 3 years, and I just really felt one night, I really felt God kind of pressing it on my heart, like it's time to meet them, because you kind of go through the thoughts of like, what if it's hard for them to meet me, you know, like for them to have gone through a process of losing someone so dearly, while on the other side of it, me and my family are rejoicing, and we're so grateful at another chance of life. It's a lot of mixed emotions, but I think overall the feeling I could really share is humbled, grateful, and just really at peace. And like being able to meet them and like see how they are and their personality is just, it's exciting, and I hope it's like a new relationship to build on. But yeah, it's not everyone can experience these emotions, so it's really hard to filter through. But yeah.
And we're here at Ho'omalihia, and what are you thinking when you know that he came here, you know, and his heart is beating in you now at this place that he loved?
Yeah. I think it's amazing because I grew up on this side too. I would come here and I would hike around here with friends and we'd go down to the pond. But I think that's just the beautiful part, is knowing how close we were, and even like personality and really purpose-wise, the way how his family really shares who he is has been more affirming for my reasoning and purpose that I feel called to do, but also more so now, more of a intensity to really steward this third chance at life, and being able to steward his kidney well, the organ well, and doing my best to really continue his legacy and what he loved to do. Maybe not in playing ukulele, but or musically, because I'm just not that talented, but just I love being able to understand more about his family and more about him through his family.
And you say third chance.
Well, as a Christian, oftentimes we say that we have like two birthdays or two days of birth, your natural day of birth. The second one would be the day you found out why you were born, your purpose in life. And for me, my third chance was being able to get a kidney transplant that allowed me to really live on with a life that is more sustainable than it was before.
And what are you thinking? Because this year is the 50th anniversary of transplants here in Hawaii.
Yeah. I think it's nice to have more of an awareness, to really put it out there how organ donating and transplants really, it's a blessing. It's a true blessing. And to be able to know that you can prolong someone's legacy or someone's life by just simply saying that you're wanting to donate. And at first for me, it was really difficult to receive from many like live donors, like family, and I had friends who were wanting to, but for some reason our blood types weren't the same, or it just didn't work out. And that's why me and Kavika's family are just saying like, this was perfect, this was truly meant to be. But really bringing more awareness to organ donation and how much of a blessing it can become, and wanting to even be able to share that more and more, because both sides of the family, I feel, gets blessed.
Yeah. And I remember checking the box.
Yeah.
You know?
I did too. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That people don't realize how much that means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't know the complete details of how his ability to donate or how it came to be, but by simply being able to check off that box, you never really know, but really the family at the end gets blessed to see that he's able, or you're able, to bless a life that can continue on and on. And in truth I never really cared much for it, and especially when I just got my permit at 16, I'm like, oh, I want to keep all my organs. But not realizing it's like, once your time has come to be able to share that gift of life to someone else in hopes that they'll be able to steward it well, in hopes that they'll be able to bless someone else with it well by living out their life, it's really a blessing, and it's really something to advocate and something to really encourage. So, yeah.
And is there something else you can share too? Because your kidney problems came about, you understand, maybe through strep throat?
Mm, yeah. I guess just being more aware. I think, especially living in Hawaii, sometimes we have that laid-back attitude, or we don't really educate ourselves, especially we have a lot of things going on right now in controversy. But I think it's time for us to, as Hawaii local residents as a whole, and just really in human perspective, or really just being able to become more aware of things like this, because I think we get so, especially living on an island, we get so in our own boxes or so inward and just kind of like protecting our own or dealing with our own things, when there's just such a bigger world out there. There's
right.
It's huge. Like, we love traveling, and yet when we come back to Hawaii, we become so comfortable. And I think we have to break that mentality and perspective that, aside from just us being on an island, it's more of like humanitarian-wise, that you can still bless others by being able to know something simply as organ donating can definitely change a life. And I think becoming more aware of it can really stir and just really change us in general.
Yeah.
That being able to selflessly give and donate is really one of the most humble things I think we can really do as humans, is to truly serve. And as a Christian, that's exactly what Jesus did. He came down to serve us, and he came from a place where he seemed comfortable. He came from heaven, where he was sitting on a throne, but to come down and to really live out the life as a human being, to be humbled in that way but still serve us, I think that's really ways and opportunities as human beings, and for us to be able to serve back to those who don't even know Jesus. But
right.
Yeah.
And then what was the name of the condition that you had again?
It was IgA nephropathy. So IgA is a type of antibody that is found in our bodies, and what had happened was that this antibody kind of multiplied too much, to a point where it started to attack my kidneys rather than just trying to attack the root of my strep throat, because it was actually really trying to heal me. But then they kind of it's like an autoimmune disease where your own immune system attacks you. So that was the root of it.
And that was Jennifer Gieb reflecting on what led to a condition that triggered the need for a kidney transplant. For links to Legacy of Life and learn more about the anniversary of organ transplants in Hawaii, go to hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today, we delve into the archives and look at when the growing demand for affordable and movable facilities during World War II was at an all-time high. Enter the Quonset Hut, Known to locals as kamaboko houses because of their fish cake shape, these shelters were simple wood frame structures covered by canvas tents with protruding windows. About 155,000 Quonset huts of various shapes and sizes were constructed during the Second Great War to house the continuous flow of soldiers throughout American strongholds. The Quonset hut had the smallest shipping cube per man housed in the history of any temporary shelter and only required one day and 10 men to construct. Following the war, Honolulu and many other places faced a housing shortage, so building supply companies capitalized on the opportunity and began salvaging the huts for resale. Now that you have had your history lesson, can you tell us how the Quonset Hut got its name? Well, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, a private school for girls in grades preschool through high school, where the focus is on science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
Coming Saturday, August 10th to HPR's Atherton Studio. It's an evening of local folk from island troubadour Gordon Freitas. Equal parts songwriter and storyteller, Freitas puts an island spin on folk rock. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org or call the station during business hours. Sponsored by Amoresco.
And the folks are coming down with the holly of a bypass blue.
I'm Bert Lum. Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll find out about the impact of artificial intelligence and how students can get involved. We'll talk to the team at OceanNet about how they've built a curriculum to help high school students learn about AI and get a jump on this exploding field. That's today at 6:30 p.m. on Bite Marks Cafe.
There's a new poll out on Mauna Kea and the 30-meter telescope. That is the subject of today's reality check. Honolulu Civil Beat's political and opinion editor, Chad Blair, on the line. Morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
So, you folks did this poll.
Well, you know, everyone's been talking about this, the 30-meter telescope in Mauna Kea and the protest. And so we thought it was absolutely more than timely to reach out to folks. So we went in the field, our pollster, MRG group, and we went on August 1st and August 3rd, so 3 days of calling people. And the results were pretty solid. 64 to 31% support building the TMT. That's, that's more than a landslide. That's a really 2-to-1 margin, very compelling support for the TMT. But we should also say that we polled Governor David Ige's performance, if you will, in handling the TMT situation, crisis, really. And in that case, just 21%, only about one-fifth of voters, support how the governor has done regarding the TMT. 53% of them have a very negative view of what the governor has done or not done.
That's interesting, perception, yeah. Of, I guess, his leadership skills.
Yeah, exactly. And we did reach out to the governor and ask him. We gave him a heads up on what the results are going to be. We figured, as a courtesy, he should know. And he responded by saying that he was grateful for that. He felt somewhat encouraged that the numbers show that people still want the TMT to be built. He says that, as he has said all along, he's committed to trying reaching a solution. There's no clear indication of what that solution might be or when, but as I indicated earlier, everybody is talking and thinking about TMT right now.
Yes, and you know, we've been hearing the stories, and I think they were alluding to older polls, so it's glad to have something fresh as all this
right,
has
the
happened.
Last... we have never polled TMT. We've used the same pollster now going on 10 years for all of our races. And the only other poll in recent memory was done by the Star Advertiser.
Yes.
2 years ago. And that poll showed a greater percentage. I think it was somewhere in the 70 Not too much different, and it showed more Native Hawaiians supported it as well. But we have to be careful here. That's apples and oranges, right? It's a different polling mm-hmm. company. It was a different time, a different sample size, a different methodology. But I mentioned Hawaiians. Even though support for TMT crossed all demographic groups, income level, education level, race and ethnicity, political ideology, which is something that's really, really rare, there were a couple that stood out, and one of them was the Native Hawaiian survey. And in this case, 48% of Native Hawaiians to 44% actually opposed TMT. They were the one group, compared to Caucasians and Japanese and Filipino and Chinese, that really actually opposed the telescope, if by only a small margin. I should add one other thing. Another thing that stood out was the generational split. And we've been talking around the newsroom trying to figure out exactly why this happened. But if you're 50 years of age and older, overwhelmingly you support the TMT, 74%, right? That's three-fourths of people we've surveyed. But if you are under the age of 50, you oppose the TMT, about 54%, a majority. So not quite sure, trying to figure out exactly why there was a generational split.
And so, gosh, any other highlights you can share with us?
Well, one of the things that I think also kind of stands out, as I mentioned, it crossed political ideology. We survey controversial issues all the time. Rail comes to mind. How do you feel about Honolulu Rail? And issues like that, you'll see some differences of opinion if you identify as a liberal or as a conservative or a progressive or a Democrat or Republican. Not in this case. And our pollster said that is rare. You hardly ever see an issue in which ideology, political leanings, don't really factor into how you feel about this particular issue. And in this case, the telescope, that was pretty remarkable.
And talk about the timing of the poll, when you conducted it.
Yeah, I think that's important, and I'm glad you asked. We conducted it after the governor canceled that emergency proclamation, which, by the way, a lot of the voters that we talked to, I spoke to them directly, they said they hated that. They thought the emergency proclamation just was not necessary. They were also very upset about the arrest of the 38 kupuna, even if they support TMT. We heard that over and over. That also came after the governor extended, or rather the DLNR extended until 2021, right? Two more years to build it. But it also came before, meaning we stopped polling before the news was announced that the TMT folks actually are looking for a permit for the Canary Islands as a possible backup. It's their plan B if things don't work out. So I think that's important to understand when we went in the field and how that might have influenced what people said or did not say.
Okay. Anything else then? Do you want to underscore?
The last thing I would add is we surveyed registered voters. Some people had asked about that. Why did you survey registered voters? Well, two reasons. One, that's how we've always done it. That way our poll is consistent. And two, they're the people that are residents of Hawaii. It's not someone who's coming in here as an outsider, someone who's maybe going to grad school or is in the military or as a visitor. They're certainly welcome here, but we felt it was important as people that live here, how they feel about issues that are directly impacting the state of Hawaii.
All right. Okay. Thanks so much, Chad.
Thanks, Catherine.
We've been talking with Honolulu Civil Beat political and opinion editor Chad Blair for today's Reality Check. To read all the details about this latest poll, visit civilbeat.org. The Rainbow Film Festival kicks off tomorrow. It offers a plethora of full-length movies to short films celebrating a cross-section of communities across the nation. Here's a clip from a film entitled Gay Chorus in the Deep South.
Our focus is every person that we do meet has an interaction that changes them.
An 83-year-old woman in this church, this morning she came up to me after worship and she said, I get it.
I am not.
And that was largely because you all were here.
In a rainbow.
Good. I enjoyed
that concert. Opened the door, a big wave of love.
I am love.
I made a quilt for you as a reminder that you always find people, even in the most unlikely of places, that want to wrap you in the warmth of friendship and understanding and acceptance.
You have allowed me to come home. And we want to thank you for that.
Music heals. It's healing me.
Dean Hamer helped to curate the offerings at the film festival, but this year, 2019, will mark efforts over three decades to fill a void in the community with the humble beginnings of a festival about gay pride.
I think what we're most excited about is this is the 30th anniversary of the Honolulu Gay Lesbian Film Festival. And back in 1989, it was a very different situation for our community. Just being gay was illegal in many places. It was the beginning of the AIDS crisis. And there was simply no way for us to see ourselves or hear our voices on screen. And so a few people decided to start a film festival. One of them was Jack Law, who runs Hula's Bar and Grill, which is still there and still a sponsor of the festival. And they started showing films, and it's been going ever since then. It's one of the longest-running gay film festivals in the country.
I mean, that's amazing, too. And I'm sure probably the depth and breadth of the issues that get covered in this festival has just grown tremendously, too.
It really has. And, of course, things have changed remarkably quickly. It's no longer illegal to be gay. We can get married. We can have kids. We can be a full part of society. We're well recognized. But at the same time, there's still a need for the community to gather together. And increasingly, there's a need for us to show the different ways that we're interacting with everybody else, that we're not only interested in queer issues, that we're interested in all the same issues as everybody else, whether it's the environment or healthcare or anything that you can imagine.
One of the films you'll be highlighting is Gay Chorus Deep South. Talk about that.
Well, Gay Chorus Deep South is a film that came about after the 2016 election, when the whole gay community, I think, was in shock a little bit and very afraid of all losing many of the rights that we had gained over the years. And so the Gay Men's Chorus in San Francisco, which is a large, very well-established group, as you can imagine, decided to go on a tour of the Deep South to sort of try and get at the root and understand better and open up a conversation in the communities where they were experiencing the most difficulty. And this came as some states were passing bathroom laws that wouldn't let transgender people use the bathroom of their choice. So 300 gay men from San Francisco went to the Deep South, and they were led by Tim Selig, who is the leader of the chorus, and who had been the leader of a large Baptist chorus in Houston, Texas, married, two kids. When he came out, lost everything, kicked out of the church, kicked out of his family, kicked out of his community, ended up in San Francisco. And he's going back for the first time in 30 years. And it's just a very heartwarming sort of series of vignettes of what it's like to be from a conservative community and what it takes to be yourself in your own home, which is something that I think will resonate everywhere, including here in Hawaii.
And was that something that they did traveling the South, or is it just focused on you know, the one part of town where he's from?
They traveled all over the South. In many cases, they recapitulated the routes that were taken during the Civil Rights Movement. They went over the bridge in Selma. Some of the choruses and events were held in historic Black churches where some of the great civil rights movements and fights occurred. So there really are tie-ins to the politics that have been going on for a long time.
And then we've seen a change also in the administration, and you know, we watched with the "Don't Ask, Don't Tell," and then the President Trump's orders about gays in the military. You know, so it certainly is bringing this issue up in a different light now.
Yes, it really is. And one of the things that is covered very nicely in the film festivals is that we have several short films about kids that are gender fluid or non-binary or somewhere in between male and female. Here in Hawaii, we have a tradition of being mahu that sort of covers that and understands that that's part of life. But in the rest of the United States and in many Asian countries, it's not always so easy. This is really important because one of the advances we had here in Hawaii is that transgender kids are now recognized in their schools, in society, governed, protected by the law. the federal government is now taking away those protections. They've already kicked transgender people out of the military. They've changed the laws in schools so that kids can't go to the right bathroom or be themselves. And that's why it's really important for people to see positive portrayals of our community and to see kids who are finding themselves. And we have a number of films that cover that.
And you just produced a film about one of our members in the community, Hina. Talk about that film.
One of the films we're excited about is called After Earth. It is about four women who are using their cultural talents and their art to struggle for environmental justice and for social justice. And I think it's a super relevant film right now because this is not a film about queerness per se. It's not about gay rights. It's about people who happen to be gay or transgender or lesbian or queer using their talents to fight for the rights of everybody. And one of those people is Kumu Hina, Hina Le Moana Wankulu, who we made a film about a few years ago called Kumu Hina. And she is one of the participants. She sings her song Kua Heo, which has now become the anthem for the Mauna and for the protection of Mauna Akea. And anybody in Hawaii knows that Hina has been very heavily involved in that movement. She's one of the security officers. They've actually formed a group called Mana Mahu, which is bringing together Mahu to be part of this. So I think it's a wonderful film because it really brings together the queer community with a straight community fighting for a common cause and recognizing that it's all the same thing, whether you're fighting against colonialism or against homophobia. It really is the same progressive movement. We're also very excited. That film, the director, Jess Snow, is coming out. The film has local roots. One of the writers, Kat Yan, was from here. And so we have a lot of local connections.
Okay, so you really have a variety of films, you said, from the South, here in the Pacific, and throughout Asia.
Yes, we have a wonderful collection of shorts. We joined a group called the Asia-Pacific Queer Film Festival Alliance recently. It's a group of festivals doing queer stuff every place from mainland China, where they're essentially outlawed and it's completely underground, to Hong Kong, where who knows what's happening, to Vietnam, Thailand, Indonesia, where there's a great deal of prejudice, to Australia and New Zealand, where things are more like they are here. And these shorts range from a portrait of an old gay guy who's losing his looks and tries to buy his way out of it, to young trans people, to woman love stories, to old friends, to new lovers, a whole variety. One of the wonderful things about our shorts program is that if you don't like one film, you'll like the next one. There's always a lot of them.
I was just going to ask, I don't know if you helped to curate the films, but do you have a special favorite that you're excited for folks to see?
You know, much as I'm a social activist and love politics, every once in a while, especially recently, you just got to relax. And the funnest film this year is our opening film. It's called The Shiny Shrimps. And it's about a gay water polo team in France. And they all wear Speedos, and they all do French funny type of stuff. And it's really a kick. And that's happening on Thursday the 8th. And I hope people will come out because even if you're not gay, even if you're not queer, you'll enjoy this film. It's a hoot.
Okay. It sounds terrific. Sounds like fun. Yeah. All right. And then the film festival runs for 2 weekends, correct?
We're running 2 weekends. It starts on Thursday the 8th, and then we have films Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Saturday is Gay Chorus Deep South and After Earth, the film that features Hina Le Moana Wankulu and Jess Snow. And Tim Seelig, who's the director of the choir, will be here for that. And then we pick up again the next weekend, again starting on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. We have some fabulous drag performers. If you watch RuPaul's Drag Race, you're going to see Gia Gunn and Shangela and some other people whose names I can't pronounce. And it's really going to be a hoot. They have films, and they're going to be at Scarlet, and there's a big party and everything too.
Okay, so there's something for everyone.
Pretty much something for everyone, yeah.
Okay, well, thanks so much, Dean.
Thank you so much.
And we're going to leave you with a clip from After Earth featuring Kumuhula Hina Moana Wankulu. Oh,
na o iwi o Hawaii nei, no ku ula hui e a avipau, ai ola mau.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Gina Davis and director Maria Geis talk about the shortage of opportunities for women in Hollywood. Davis founded her Institute on Gender in Media. Geis' activism led to an EEOC investigation into systemic discrimination against women directors. They're featured in the new documentary, This Changes Everything. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Aloha, I'm Mark Wagner from San Francisco. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Earlier in the program, we asked you how the Quonset Hut got its name. So here's the story. World War II presented many new challenges to the country, including mass shortages on everything from metal to housing. The Department of Defense came up with a temporary solution to the housing shortage by producing Quonset huts, locally referred to as a kamaboko house because of its fish cake appearance. These cheap mobile forms of housing were no more than wood frames and floors covered by canvas tents and were primarily used for the continuous flow of soldiers as they were deployed not only in the Pacific but around the world. After the war ended, Honolulu, along with the rest of the country, continued to face housing shortages, extending the need for Quonset huts. Many building supply companies in Honolulu, like Dan's Lumberyard and Frank Fossey's Supply Company, began buying the huts for resale, a venture that made many very wealthy. The name Quonset Hut derives from the place of initial production, Quonset, Rhode Island, which retained its Native American name, Small Long Place. And congratulations to Gordon Sasaki from Honolulu. You got it right. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org. If you're looking to refresh your soul, dipping into the art scene always helps. HPR's Nui Tanigawa has dropped in with another speed tour of art shows around town.
Kind of, yeah.
Busy summer, huh?
Well, I think we should start today in Hilo. How's that?
Okay.
At the East Hawaii Cultural Center. Have you ever been there, Catherine? Mm-hmm. It's way up on the Wailuku Riverside of Hilo over there, the opposite side from the the open market. Those of us who don't go to Hilo all the time, we got to orient ourselves, right? The building itself is shady, gracious. It's right across from Kalakaua Park, this beautiful, shady, gracious park there on that side of Hilo. Used to be the old Hilo police headquarters. So they've got columns in the front. It's got 12-foot ceilings inside. And right now, Stephen U. Lang's installed his show Roots in there. Picture this. Towering, slender albizia trunks that have just been stripped clean, and they're going there. Some of them are 8 feet wide. They go from the floor up through to the ceiling, and they kind of represent the world that Lang imagines underground. These works, represent roots, and they're actually his second shot at this whole show. He lost almost everything last June in 2018 when lava overran his studio and entire home there in Kapoho.
There were some pieces in there that I really wished that I'd done whatever was necessary to save. They haunt me still, but the lava came and ate my house, ate my farm, ate my car, and it ate my whole show. So, obviously, when you lose on that level, there's a degree of mourning that you're going to go through. And this show gave me something to do and something to focus on so that I could produce something instead of wallowing.
Well, I mean, but Stephen, this theme, roots.
Yeah, that they are probably, they're unbelievably significant in human existence. We don't treat them well. We blacktop areas. We do our best to prevent root growth. We're at war with it with chemicals. But it truly is, in relation to the soil, the foundation for everything. On land, roots are our connection to life.
Well, you just were horribly uprooted.
I was uprooted. Good point. Yes, very definitely. And we've arrived at a new location, and it's taking us a long time to get roots down, but truly we are, and we're finding a deep love growing for this place.
Yeah, you know, Lang said that he thought he'd never replace his love for Kapoho, Catherine, but Onomea is really growing on him and his wife, Kaori Ukaji. You know, it's just so neat. I asked him, what does it take to grow your roots in a place? And he says, well, now that we've started to meet the people, we're really starting to appreciate their new place, their Onomea, now north of Hilo. Good for them. Yes. And you know what? So he's showing there at the East Hawaii Cultural Center in the Mauka Gallery, in the Makai Gallery, installation by Monica Mann called Follow the Light. And that's all at the East Hawaii Cultural Center, free and open to the public. Definitely check that out. Now look, Mayumi Oda from Keala Kekua is opening here in Honolulu this coming Friday at Cedar Street Galleries. You know her work, exuberant nymphs and, you know, Buddhist iconography kind, right? Well, she's opening with Yvonne Chang, okay? Think of her work, right? The stately women in kapa. And they're both showing with the indomitable Peggy Hopper. As soon as I heard Peggy was showing, I mean, I had to give her a call.
Really happy to see this show come up over the horizon here, Peggy.
Oh, my God. It's my swan song, I'll tell you.
What makes you say that?
Well, of course, I say that about everything. But, you know, I'm 84 years old now, Noe. And
You expect respect for that? Or kudos
expect,
at 84? That's almost young.
What I expect is for everybody to tell me to lie down, shut up, and get out of my way.
But it's not happening? What's up?
It is. It is happening. I am totally getting out of the gallery business. And
are you?
I'm going to sell my building.
Oh, no. Really?
For sale. It's for sale. And I am going to be an artist and not a gallery owner.
Oh, my gosh. You mean finally?
Finally.
What, I mean, Catherine, who knew, right?
Wow.
Here's a successful gallery, one of the few galleries in Chinatown that's managed to stay open over the decades. And here she is with an extremely popular style of work that fed it. And Peggy said, at times she felt it was like a millstone around her neck. Mm. I mean, it's just so fascinating. And, you know, but Peggy, we had a terrific conversation, you know, and I just got to say, people love her women for a reason, right? For me, a lot of it is their gaze. And, you know, the way the women look at you. And, you know, the gaze is a big deal in Western art history, right? And the way hers happened to look at you just grabbed me so much. I feel like Peggy's women have interior lives. And I asked her, what might be behind that look they've got?
I went to the archives when I was working for Jack Siegel and looked through some old photographs. Actually, it was King Kalakaua's photo collection. And the women sitting on their lahala mats down at Hanama Bay, these were photographs, looking so, so cool. Not smiling, looking right at the camera, not grinning, not posing. It's like they were totally self-actualized. These were strong women. Not trying to be beautiful, not trying to be skinny, just there in all their glory.
Oh.
I think that affected me a lot.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Hopper's a huge supporter of women's causes. She's pulled together so many women artists and shows there at her gallery there on Nu'uanu, which is now for sale.
Wow.
May some great gallery owner buy it. And Melanie Yang, Peggy's trusty manager, is going to go on to develop her work online where paintings already sell. So that's pretty good for Peggy. She's going to keep selling her paintings anyway. Go Melanie, definitely.
Yes. But so then we've got this kind of collage of
women
showing together at Cedar Street. Have you ever been to Cedar Street Gallery?
Yes.
It's there. I don't think a lot of people know where it is here, just off of Ke'eaumoku. How would you describe where
is? I just remember it was near the ice cream place.
Exactly. Place. Right there you go.
Awesome gelato.
So two in one. It's Yvonne Chang, Mayumi Oda, and Peggy Hopper. They're opening at Cedar Street Galleries there this Friday, 5:30 to 8. Stop by. And what's great is these are people you often see giclées of their work. There is nothing like that in this show. It's all original. So that's going to be a great thing to see there at Cedar Street Gallery. It opens Friday again, and it'll be on display until September 8th.
Yeah, I've always felt that that was kind of another one of those secret places you could, you know, just find some incredible artwork because it's hidden away in those little alleys back
there. I know,
right?
Those streets with names like Cedar and Birch and so on, right?
Yes.
And the gelato place right there in the same parking lot. So there's a lot of reasons to find Cedar Street Gallery.
It's a real treat. I agree. And, you know, when you talk about the gaze, I get it because I remember when my kids were little and I wanted to have them take a serious portrait. And it was great. The photographer, Mr. Honda, you know, has a studio, but I just remember he just got them to just look in the camera, and it was that you could just kind of see their soul, you know?
Exactly.
But I know exactly what she's talking about with that gaze.
That's one thing we like about Peggy's work.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Noe.
Thank you.
That was a fun speed tour. That was Noe Tanigawa with the latest snapshot of the art scene around town. So many choices, so little time.
When Susie saw an ad for a free slot machine game she could play on her phone, she thought, why not?
It was super easy to get in there and get online and start playing.
But this free game cost her hundreds of thousands of dollars.
I feel targeted. I was nothing but a pawn, just money.
Now Susie's money went into Facebook's pocket on the next reveal.
This evening at 7, right after Bite Marks Cafe.
That's it for today. Join us tomorrow as we tip our hats to a fifth-generation family business in Hilo that turns 98 years old. Tell us what you think. Suggest a story idea. Call our talkback line. Call 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation, HPR, or Twitter at HI Conversation. This show and all the past ones found on the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation. Hawaii Talks.